Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and our guest, as usual, once a week, we invite Auburn Center nutritionist Layla Mudin to join us in the studio for Q&A with Layla. That means an opportunity for both of us in tandem to answer your questions, and we've got a bunch of questions this week. By the way, the way to get us questions, email us to radioprogram@AOL.com. And an additional added bonus is if you email us your question and provide us with your phone number, I will endeavor to answer your question during the weekend edition of Health Talk, which is heard Saturdays from noon to 2 p.m. nationally. For the month of April, we're rebroadcast later on Sunday from 11 p.m. to midnight. So we need your calls. Email us with questions. We will call you between noon and 2 p.m. on Saturday, put you on the air, and then you can tell all your friends and families to listen to you because you will be on the radio and you will have instant fame and notoriety. You get the whole neighborhood to sit around the radio to hear you answer, to hear you pose your question, and I'll endeavor to answer it. All right. So after taking care of business, we'll get to your questions. But Layla, you would be very proud of me because last night I had a very, very paleo dinner. I went to Whole Foods.
Yeah.
And, you know, they don't always have everything, but they happen to have fresh, organic, grass-fed beef liver there.
Ooh.
And so I bought some of that. And I sautéed some onions, and I put in some – I had some leftover natural bacon that I had made a couple of days before. I always save a little extra. And I put that in with the sautéed onions, and then I sautéed the liver, and I
– Delish.
Yeah, I added a little white wine.
White wine, okay.
White wine mm-hmm. to that. And then I – what do you call it when you sort of render it down? You there's a word for it in cuisine, but and then it made sort of a nice sauce mm-hmm. for the liver, and I added paprika and salt and thyme, and it turned out great. It
was beautiful
very satisfying. It's like a real great winter meal because you might not want to have that on a hot night in August,
no.
But man, the weather's been really cold here. I needed some fortification.
Good for you. What were your side dishes?
I actually didn't have a carb with that, so I was proud of that. So this is really like a salad and salmon type diet, except the protein was from the liver. And I had a salad that I made with a bunch of different lettuces. I had some romaine, and I had mescaline, kind of that mix.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had some arugula. I mixed that together. Then I had some red onion in that. As if I didn't have enough onions on the liver, I had to have raw onions on my salad.
Red onion is made for salad; it just goes very, very well.
Yeah. Yeah. So I had that, and I had some. I had some chopped walnuts on that, and I also had some chopped beets on that.
Wow! Nice.
Now, in the old days when I was having dairy, I would have sprinkled a little bit of goat cheese on top.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm off dairy these days, so I just had
terrific.
I just had that and some chopped walnuts, and that was a great accompaniment to the liver. So I had a nutritious dinner while I was watching the Academy Awards.
Oh yeah. Okay, sounds very, very nourishing.
Right. So I enjoyed the awards and had a good dinner and. Overall, a good end to the weekend. And then I popped off to bed, and just before I went to bed, I got to listen to myself on the radio just for a few minutes.
That's right.
Yeah, just to make sure that they got the repeat on on the program on Sunday nights. So so that was the perfect end to a weekend. They actually managed to pull it off, get the recorded broadcast on the air, and that was good. All right, so we have a bunch of questions.
Yes.
What's on your question list?
What I've got, this is from, let's see here, this is, I don't have the person's name. Hi, Dr. Hoffman. I recently learned that organic produce may be sprayed with natural pesticides which could be as dangerous as synthetic pesticides. Have I been a fool for buying organic all these years? Is it possible to get fruits and vegetables that are truly pesticide-free? Mr. Natural. This is from somebody named Mr. Natural. Yeah.
So, you know, I don't know the precise ins and outs of organic farming. I have a friend who is an organic farmer in Maine, and he says that it is virtually impossible to raise apples without doing something to the apples. Mm-hmm. And he uses natural methods, but he uses natural repellents, various types of, quote, natural products, not highly chemicalized products, but things that keep the insects from eating up all his apples. I mean, if you look at an untreated apple tree, a lot of people have apple trees, the apples are virtually inedible. You know, if they're growing in your yard.
Right.
I mean, they're good for throwing. You can throw them at cars or, you know, throw them at whatever. Throw them up against the wall. But they're all mealy and they're all eaten up by bugs.
That's true. Although there are certain bugs which may be helpful. I don't know of the species,
right,
but there's a long list.
That they compete. That's right, yeah. Like sort of eco-friendly competitive species mm-hmm. that help to mm-hmm. eat the bad bugs. So that's a good way to go, but...
One thing I just read recently, for insects as well as fungal disease, some cooking oil, some baking soda, a few drops of Ivory soap in a quart of water, and you spray it. Hmm. And even things like cayenne pepper as well can be helpful.
Right.
So these are some – the natural pesticides are not meant to harm humans. It's really just the insects. And I think ladybugs are also very good for
– ladybugs, you don't want to – when a ladybug lands on me, first of all, it's bad luck to kill a ladybug.
Well, it's good luck when they land on you.
It's good luck when they land.
Yeah,
but I think it's really, if it's good luck when they land on you and then you kill it, that's not a good thing.
That can't be good.
So I just said, okay, little ladybug, you know, fly off to wherever you're from and, you know. But they apparently are good for controlling other insects.
That's true. Whole ecosystem there.
Right.
Or organic produce is meant to be truly man-made chemical harmful pesticide-free.
Right.
You know, we're not getting any Roundup
on
organic produce. And speaking of which, Roundup, they're finding there might be some association to why we have so much gluten sensitivity.
Yes. That's very interesting.
Which is fascinating.
That glyphosate, which is Roundup, apparently can irritate the gastrointestinal tract. And even if it does not cause disease itself, it may... They say, mm-hmm. I mean, this is speculation now. I don't think it's been conclusively proven. But this may be one of the contributing factors to our epidemic of gluten sensitivity, is that we sensitize our GI tract to wheat, which in past centuries we've been able to tolerate. Mm-hmm. And because of the glyphosate, it irritates the gastrointestinal tract.
Yeah. So people stop using Roundup. Let the weeds grow. Many of them are pretty. Just kind of let it be.
I used to use Roundup. I must, because it was so satisfying. Mm. You know, you have like weeds on your driveway, and I would just go around with this little like container with like a squirt gun, and I would just hit the weeds with. It's very satisfying to make the weeds go away and have like the perfect gravel driveway.
Did you wear a hazmat suit while you did this?
I was foolish. I didn't. I probably created incalculable damage, but I got away from that. That's not good for the environment. That's a guy thing. You know, you want to like, it's kind of like, you know, recreating bombing runs over Dresden. You know, with
kill the weeds.
Kill the weeds. Eradicate the weeds. Them. You know, but not a good thing. All right. What else you got?
I've got another question from Sam about carpal tunnel syndrome. Dear Dr. Hoffman, I've been having horrible pain in both my hands. I believe that it is carpal tunnel syndrome. Are there other types of treatments besides armbands and pain medicines? First of all, Sam, get diagnosed with carpal tunnel syndrome. And if I may speak from experience, back in 1992 when I used to be a secretary at ESPN Networks, right before the launch of ESPN2.
That's when they still had secretaries. They called you a secretary?
Yeah, or an admin assist.
Oh, okay.
Anyway, the point is we were all running on overtime typing up brand new affiliation agreements. I was literally typing 12 hours a day.
Oh.
And one day I went into my boss and I said, I can't feel my pinky.
Oh.
So they sent me off to get treated and all the right things that a good company such as they would do. And carpal tunnel, first you want to get that diagnosed correctly. And then, you know, besides pain or
I'll mention, just to interrupt you, mm-hmm. the concern is that carpal tunnel syndrome, if it advances and is untreated, it can sometimes lead to permanent nerve damage.
That's true. Yeah.
So I think it's important to at least get a proper assessment. It could be something else.
That's true.
Hand arthritis of a different kind, mm-hmm. which may require a different treat. It could be rheumatoid arthritis. Maybe osteoarthritis. It could be carpal tunnel. Just to describe what carpal tunnel is there's a little tunnel that is a narrow, narrow passageway that contains what's called the carpal or the ulnar nerve. I believe it's the ulnar nerve. And when that nerve gets compressed, you can get sort of an electric sensation, or you can get pain, or you can get numbness, and sometimes you get weakness and loss of function in your hand, which is devastating. So you really want to get a proper workup and diagnosis from a hand orthopedist. There are such people.
Yeah. I read, I think it was in one of Johnny Bowden's book, very famous nutritionist, that insulin resistance is also related to carpal tunnel.
It certainly can be.
So that's worth mentioning.
Well, any condition that increases obesity is going to, so take a few pounds off your waistline and you may actually, that narrow tunnel may have more room to accommodate the nerve.
Yeah.
Another condition that predisposes to that is hypothyroidism. Actually, hypothyroidism causes some swelling or edema in the tissue, and sometimes treatment for that can help. Also, a guy named Ellis came up with a protocol for carpal tunnel using high doses of vitamin B6. And we may want to use doses as high as, you know, 100 twice daily, 200 twice daily. You have to be careful when you take B6. You can't take it alone. You should take it with a B-complex.
That's
because some people can develop B6 toxicity.
Mm-hmm.
And, by the way, the test for carpal tunnel syndrome is an EMG.
That's a
painful test. Electric shock. Right.
Torture.
So what was the outcome? How did you...
He said there's no nerve damage, but, you know, the neurologist at the beginning of the test said this could actually cause nerve damage, the test I'm giving you. And I said, oh.
So you decided at that point to get a second career in the field of nutrition. You said, this ain't working out. This secretary thing ain't working out. Right?
Right.
So thank goodness for carpal tunnel syndrome, because it propelled you into a second career, which you're really good at.
I do want to say that physical therapy was the best thing that happened to me at that point in time. I didn't need to have any surgery.
You used those splints?
Nothing. Oh, yeah. I went to bed every night looking like an NFL linebacker. Yes.
Wow. That must have been really romantic. Yeah. You know, it's like in bed, you know, it's like, sorry, honey.
Can't tie my shoelaces either.
Right.
But no, it was absolutely worth it.
They're called cock-up splints. Cock-up splints, which put your wrist back at a 90-degree angle, sort of.
No, it actually put it straight.
Because
I was told that this is bad, but this is worse.
Okay.
So back is actually bad, but this way is worse.
I see. So just straight up.
Yeah, straight up.
Okay. Yeah. And then you didn't know about B6 in those days.
I did, and I told my neurologist what I was doing, and he said, well, don't take that much, when I told him I was simply taking a 50-milligram B-complex along with additional B6.
Well, he might have been reading an article by a famous neurologist at my medical school. His name escapes me right now, but he wrote a very alarmist article about B6 for carpal tunnel syndrome, suggesting that it could cause a lot of toxicity with weird neurological symptoms. He found a group of women who had balance problems, he said, and various types of symptoms from overdosing on B6 because they were taking high dose of B6 for PMS and for carpal tunnel syndrome.
Good for water retention, yeah.
But I haven't seen that type of ODing, and people, you know, need to be a little cautious about taking doses more than 200 or 300 milligrams of B6 a day.
You should do it under supervision.
Under supervision.
Mm-hmm.
We could go higher, but under supervision.
Mm-hmm.
What else you got?
Let's see here. Oh, hello. This is from Caroline. My mother is a big fan of your program and recommended that I contact you. I was interested in your estrogen dominance article. Are there any reasons not to mix metformin and inositol? Anything I should know about?
Okay, so you want to start with the definition of estrogen dominance, and I'll chime in.
Estrogen dominance typically happens with women who are entering perimenopause or so, when progesterone levels begin to go down. So you no longer have that balance.
But that could happen as early as 35.
Sure.
Yeah. In other words, you don't have to wait till you're 50 because in the latter part of your menstrual history, you might become higher in estrogen, lower in progesterone.
That's true. That's true.
And women have what are called anovulatory cycles, which means they menstruate, they bleed, but they're not making an egg. Mm-hmm. And the egg, actually, in a part of the egg called the corpus luteum, that makes progesterone. So if you don't make an egg, you're not making progesterone for the eventual pregnancy that, in this case, is not going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get a lot of estrogen, but not enough progesterone, so there's an imbalance. So big deal. What's the problem with that?
Well, it could be a risk factor for uterine fibroids, possibly. I'm not sure about endometriosis.
Absolutely, endometriosis and endometrial cancer.
Endometrial cancer, fibrocystic breasts.
Yep.
All of that.
And so, also mood stuff, like, you know, really moodiness. Progesterone is actually a more relaxing hormone when it comes to the brain. Estrogen, sorry, this may sound sexist, but it's more associated with anxiety and a peculiarly sexist word, which is hysteria. That word actually comes from hyster, which is Greek for uterus. So it's, you know, when...
Oh, my goodness.
So if a guy calls you a hysterical woman, you know, punch him, because it's really a sexist thing. But hysteria refers to, I guess, a particularly, quote, feminine quality of anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's plenty of hysterical men. But the thought is that estrogen may increase that.
Mm.
So... Mm-hmm. Progesterone actually works on GABA receptors. GABA is the receptor in the brain that benzodiazepine drugs work on.
Yeah, most like our natural Valium.
Right.
Yeah. And chills us out, progesterone.
Yes. So,
but I think small amounts of progesterone are also made, like the adrenal glands, as well as some other, maybe not a whole lot, but...
That's actually a good question. I'm not even sure. I know that estrogen can be made, but I'm not sure that progesterone can be made. But in any case, when you've got estrogen dominance, the typical appearance of an estrogen dominant woman is a little bit plump or zoftig, juicy. You know, we can think of like Jane Mansfield was probably a little estrogen dominant, you know, large breasts and hips.
Curvaceous.
Who can we think of as not estrogen dominant as an actress? Somebody very like super slender, flat chested. Maybe Kate Blanchett might not
Kate
be.
Blanchett,
she doesn't
maybe.
Look very estrogen dominant.
Yeah, no,
you know,
not
you know.
At all.
Okay.
Yeah.
So now with this, I don't know what's going on with this woman because she's actually asking about treatment for something else.
Yeah.
Which is polycystic ovarian syndrome or PCOS, which is common among women, and it involves some degree of insulin resistance.
Yes.
And
high androgens, which is different from estrogen dominance.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So you overproduce androgens because the adrenals in this case are making androgens.
Mm.
And you get women who have acne or have excess body hair. They tend to be overweight.
Mm-hmm.
They tend to have irregular periods, infertility. That's PCOS. And the other thing that she mentions, inositol, is also a treatment for PCOS. Some people use something called dechiroinositol.
Mm-hmm.
We have a product called dipinitol, P-I-N-O-T-O-L, which is helpful for that. But actually, some studies suggest that regular old inositol, which is a cheap B vitamin, can be helpful for PCOS. But you have to use high doses. You have to use, you know, a few grams a day.
Okay. Inositol has very calming effects.
Calming effects, too.
It's great for anxiety.
Yes.
If you go above 10 grams, you might get a laxative response, or you might just get very sleepy.
If you go to dearhoffman.com, right now featured, I think, on the front page is an article that I wrote about estrogen dominance. But among the things that help, DIM helps. That's from cabbage family.
Calcium deglucarate.
Yes.
Brevail
from flaxseed, exercise, a diet that's lower in carbohydrates.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to PCOS, the other condition, vitamin D plays a role in that. Many of those patients are low in vitamin D. So anyway, go to drhoffman.com. We have an all-new website, and I'm amazed by the profusion of things that keep coming up on that, because not only do I write stuff, you write stuff, but I also have some great contributors.
Yeah.
And we have some real great webmasters who keep refreshing the material there so that every time you look, there's always something new, and they have great, what I love is the pictures.
Yeah.
They have like a great art collection. so that each story is accompanied by this really cool picture. I can hardly wait to see what they're going to come up with when I write a new article. So, anyway.
Just to tie this up, metformin and inositol, there isn't any interaction.
And there is not an interaction, a negative interaction. You know where there is an interaction is metformin depletes vitamin B12. It is known to deplete vitamin B12.
I think folate.
And folate, okay. There are nutrient depletions. Certain medications eat up certain vitamins and minerals.
If she's given metformin for insulin resistance, that could help with the estrogen dominance. Weight loss is good for the estrogen dominance.
You know what's interesting about metformin? Metformin is a diabetes drug, but it helps the blood sugar in patients who have PCOS, but it also helps to make them more fertile, which is really an interesting effect for a drug that works on blood sugar. It will actually help with fertility. Some women who can't get pregnant because of PCOS, they take metformin and bang, they get pregnant. That's a weird effect of a medication. And you know, metformin, it's a very old drug and it's based on an herb called goat's rue. Goat's rue contains a natural ingredient, which is like the active ingredient of metformin. So in effect, what you've got is a synthetic version of a natural medication. Now, you may say, well, why can't it just take goat's rue? Well, you know, the concentration is not that well regulated, and you know, if you brew a cup of tea or if you take a few caps, it's unclear what you're going to get. So metformin, actually, I'm not unhappy about giving to some of our patients, even though it is a drug.
Would you ever substitute CM-Core and diaxanol for that, or is it a different mechanism?
That's a great question, and it turned in toe-to-toe comparisons. CM-Core, which is a combination of berberine and grape seed extract, works. I think they did the study just on berberine. They didn't do it on the CM-Core product, but berberine alone works as well as metformin in terms of controlling blood sugar, but I think the mechanisms are different.
Okay.
So actually, we have some patients on both, and they do fine.
Yeah.
I mean, we just saw such a patient today taking both. He was diabetic when he first came in. Now he's not diabetic. Thanks, I think, in large part to you, Layla, because you counseled him on proper diet. But, you know, we're not sure what is doing the heavy lifting, whether it's the supplements he's taking or the rigorous diet and exercise program he's following, but his diabetes
is under
control.
It's a synergy. Absolutely.
What else we got here?
Let's see. This is from Cherie in Florida.
Like the song Cherie Amour. That old song?
Yeah. Stevie Wonder. She writes, "Dear Sir or Madam, I have IDA unspecified."
Well, that's a very interesting, you know, IDA is a very interesting acronym in medicine because we usually shorthands in medicine. Partly it's because we're writing fast, and partly it's because we want to have our own secret language. So we'll say patient is SOB. That doesn't mean that the patient is a son of a bitch. It means the patient is short of breath. Now, we might write that Cherie is IDA, but there would be two meanings for that. One meaning is that she's an intravenous drug abuser.
Oh.
It's sometimes also abbreviated IVDA, but sometimes IDA. But IDA generally means iron deficiency anemia.
Okay. She says, "All gastro and hematologists find no cause. I've had extensive blood work, hematocrit, colonoscopy, small pill camera, upper endoscopy, all normal. Hemoglobin is at 7.8.
Wait, stop. Let me comment on that. In medicine, when someone turns out to be anemic and has low iron, the answer is not just to give iron. Now, in a woman who's got a little low iron, who's menstruating, you might say, well, we don't have to look for some esoteric cause. You're having heavy periods, so you're a little low in iron. Or perhaps a vegetarian woman whose iron consumption is low.
Right.
We could just give you some iron pills and see if you're making blood and if your iron levels come up. If they don't, then you have to do the iron deficiency anemia workup, which is a GI workup. It's working up your gastrointestinal tract. You're losing blood, and we don't know why. So what we do is we look, you know, there's a saying in gastroenterology, We did an upper GI and we did a lower GI, and gee, I don't know what's going on. Nowadays we do endoscopy instead of upper GI, an EGD, which is an endoscopic gastroduodenoscopy, EGD, scoping from above, and then we scope from below with a colonoscopy because, God forbid, there could be, above there could be an ulcer, from below there could be cancer. That's one of the first signs of cancer is you become iron deficiency anemic. So you got to rule that out.
Right.
Okay, rule that out. Then there's this cool thing that they do. So, well, we can't find where the bleeding's coming from, but, you know, there's a, when you go from above and you go from below, it's not like, you know, with the Union Pacific Railroad meeting the Central Pacific Railroad and they drove the spike in at, in somewhere in Utah. You cannot actually join scopes from below and above. There's this little bit of a territory in between in the small intestine that you can't really visualize. And so they have this pill that's made in Israel, and it's like a TV camera that transmits an image to the outside. So you can swallow this pill, and this pill will reveal possibly a site of bleeding. I have almost never seen that pill show a site of bleeding that hasn't been picked up by upper and lower GI. But I guess, you know, that's just as a precaution.
Yeah.
This person had the million-dollar workup. Nobody can figure out why she has low iron.
Yeah.
And so we got to figure out another reason why she has low iron, because she's not losing blood. Presumably she's postmenopausal, I guess.
Presumably, but I'm not getting...
She doesn't state her age.
Yeah, she doesn't. But let me tell you, she says, taking all forms of iron, both oral and injected, ferroheme, were not well tolerated.
Right.
All anemic symptoms erupted, more so as iron increased, as if the iron was toxic to me.
Mm.
More migraines, more fatigue, aching in long bones, frail hair, paleness, restless leg syndrome with ferroheme. I had fainting spells and just felt overall
This sounds like one of the patients who come to see us. This is not a radio question. This is a complicated question.
you know what I'm saying? That's true.
Look, this is not simple.
But what it's not.
Okay, so.
And she still has declining hemoglobin.
Right. So this is really a challenging question.
Yeah.
She's getting both oral iron, and sometimes we do this in patients who don't absorb oral iron, injectable iron. And she's saying that all the symptoms that might be attributable to a low iron. So, for example, you have thinning hair. Mm-hmm. Take some iron. You go to a dermatologist and you say, my hair is thin, the first thing they'll do is they'll check your iron.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll say, take some iron pills or start eating some animal protein if you're
a
vegetarian.
Have the dinner you had last night.
Have my liver dinner. You know, that's a good way to get iron. Plus folic acid and other nutrients from liver. Liver is a really good source of nutrients, zinc and so on. But then she's going to getting injectable iron. So that really should get in, even if it's not absorbed by mouth.
Mm-hmm.
She says her hemoglobin is going down. My goodness gracious, this is like
a
challenging question. I don't know the answer, and I would have to sit with a patient like this and do a lot of testing.
Mm-hmm.
We would look for malabsorption.
Sure.
You know, I think malabsorption is often missed.
Celiac
disease, acid-blocking medications.
Mm-hmm.
We now know that acid-blocking medications block magnesium, they block iron, they block
magnesium.
B12.
Yes.
So
yes.
This is a perplexing and challenging case, and it's sort of like a day in the office for us. We get these cases all the time.
It is. Anyway, Cherie, I hope you feel better.
Cherie Amor, da 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 da. Okay. But she's not a happy camper.
No. Okay, I have one from Rich. Hi, I was wondering if you could give me your opinion on the eye supplement mesozeaxanthin. I was reading an article saying it was a synthetic form of zeaxanthin. Do you feel it's safe, effective, etc.?
Okay, so...
And Rich is a longtime listener of Health Talk.
Great.
Thank you.
Great. Previously known as Health Talk. You know, it's like the artist formerly known as Prince.
Yeah.
The radio program formerly known as Health Talk is now Intelligent Medicine. Okay, mesozeaxanthin. Well, we know about zeaxanthin, and zeaxanthin is a pigment that is found in corn. In fact, the botanical name of corn is Zea maize, and so it has something to do with yellow-colored pigments that are found in vegetables primarily, fruits also.
Egg yolks.
Egg yolks have lutein. They may have some zeaxanthin. Yeah. I guess it depends on what it's. If you feed corn to the to the chicken, then
which
there's
going
to there's going to be some zeaxanthin in there. So that is found in the retina of the eye and protects the eye. Now, meso refers to some subtype of zeaxanthin. It's not like miso soup. It's M-E-S-O. And it's a chemical structure of that that is thought to maybe be more bioavailable. But I think this is like one of those new nutrition wars, like there's alpha-lipoic acid, and then there's R-alpha-lipoic acid, which is thought to be more bioavailable, but it's not that clear. And or things like DHEA and 7-keto-DHEA, that's thought to be like a better, more safe, more bioavailable form. And the answer is we don't know the answers. So I've seen some information about miso-zeaxanthin, and I'm not sure whether it is really an advance or whether it's simply a marketing ploy. What I can say, let's go over the things that are helpful for the retina. We know that lutein and zeaxanthin are helpful for the retina. And by the way, what we're talking about is protecting against macular degeneration, which is still the major cause of blindness in Americans over, in seasoned citizens, Americans over the age of 65. So lutein and zeaxanthin are helpful. What else could we put
all in? The other carotenoids and certainly omega-3s, especially DHA.
DHA, right.
Very, very important for eye health.
The original research done on zinc with Dr. Yes. David Newsom at, I think it was University of Louisiana, and he was using high doses of zinc, like 200 milligrams of elemental zinc, but he found that was helpful. Then there have been the AREDS studies, AREDS, which have looked at antioxidants, and you know, clearly antioxidants may play a role in protecting the eye.
Vitamin C, vitamin E. I think also, just flew right out of my head what I was just going to say.
Bilberry. Right.
Okay.
Yeah, bilberry is reputed. You know, they have this story about how the RAF pilots used bilberry, and the grandmothers of Britain gathered the bilberries and made bilberry jam and gave them to the RAF pilots so the RAF pilots could get up at night during the Blitz and shoot down the German bombers because they had improved night vision because they were eating the bilberry. However, I've learned subsequently that that is an apocryphal story. In other words, it's a story that's sort of been, it's unclear if that really happened or if it was made up. But we know that bilberry improves vision, even computer vision. You know, people get eye fatigue from computers. It does have a lot to do with vision. It's it's a potent polyphenol compound from berries that, you know, it helps the brain and helps the eyes.
Will it enhance night vision? Besides,
it might.
Say,
well, actually, what helps night vision is there are rods and cones in the eye, and the cones are associated with color vision, and the rods are associated with
black and white,
and the rods are much more sensitive than the cones, so that even when you know at night you don't see in color, but you can detect light, very tiny amounts of light. You can see light like miles and miles away, a little like if somebody lights a match, you know, 10 miles away, you could see it. You have tremendously good discrimination. But it's vitamin A dependent.
It is.
And so you need to get vitamin A for that. And the vitamin A has to come from retinol, not from beta-carotene. Beta-carotene can be converted to retinol. Some people don't do such a good job. Some people need additional the vitamin A form, which comes mostly
a lot of vitamin A in that liver you had last night.
A lot of vitamin A.
Yeah, and good.
You want another story? And this is not an apocryphal story. This is a true story. True story.
Yes.
Is some Arctic explorers, I don't remember which expedition, but they were up there and, you know, they were starving and they're just running out of food. And they had Eskimo guides and they were, I think it was in the early North Pole expedition. And the reason I know that is because, did you know there's no polar bears in the South Pole?
No.
No, there's just penguins, walruses. So it's got to be the North Pole. So this story is about polar bears. So what happened is they came upon a hapless polar bear.
Uh-huh.
They were starving, and so they had ammunition and guns, and they shot the polar bear. So these guys were starving. They descended upon the bear, and they cut the bear open, and they said, man, here's the liver. This is like the best, the most healthy part. And the Eskimo said, don't eat the liver. And they said, what do you mean? That's the best part. That's the most nutritious part. The Eskimo said, look, we told you so. Don't eat the liver. Well, they ate the liver, and they developed vitamin A toxicity.
Wow.
Because polar bears, you know, they're in the Arctic where there's like a whiteout kind of situation. So they really need a lot of vitamin A to protect their the rods in their eyes.
Uh-huh.
So they actually have the opposite of night vision problems. They have snow blindness. So they have enormous concentrations of vitamin A in their livers. Anyway, the Arctic explorers,
wow,
the Europeans and the white explorers ate the liver, became sick with vitamin A toxicity, and the Eskimo said, "We told you so. You know, don't eat the liver."
Yeah.
In this case, don't eat. But you know, I didn't have polar bear liver last night.
Thankfully.
So, and I don't eat it all the time. All right.
Okay, I've got one from Carol. I'm gonna shrink this down a little. Hi,
paraphrase.
Dr. Hoffman.
Yes, paraphrase.
I've heard you speak about the MTHFR genetic mutation in the
MTHFR?
Past.
MTHFR?
Yes.
Be careful. This is a family podcast.
Yeah. But to be honest, I didn't pay that much attention because I didn't think it applied to me. However, my husband and I, we're both 62, went to see a new cardiologist recently who routinely orders more extensive blood work than we've ever done before, thankfully. In addition to comprehensive lipid panel, which included particle size and all the inflammation markers, it also included some genetic testing. Interestingly, we are both homozygous for A1298C MTHFR. Our doctor said he's not concerned because we both have optimal homocysteine. Okay? He said mine was 8. Can't seem to find my husband's right now. She said, rather. My question is there something else we should be taking or doing in light of this newfound knowledge,
right,
about this genetic,
okay,
mutation? Should we have our
yeah,
kids?
Listen, this is a hot area in the field of nutritional science. And the doctor who said, oh, it's not a problem because genetically you have this abnormality, but your homocysteine is fine, is wrong. He's wrong in terms of the latest nutritional science. MTHFR stands for methyl tetrahydrofolate reductase. And this is an enzyme in the body where there can be variations.
Mm-hmm.
And the way the genes work is they're in pairs, and you can have heterozygous or homozygous. Heterozygous means you've got one normal, one abnormal. And homozygous means double hit. It's sort of like the difference between sickle cell trait and sickle cell anemia.
They're homozygous.
So this is a problem, potentially. And we don't even know fully what the ramifications are. We will see a lot of spina bifida and miscarriages in the mothers,
mm-hmm,
I mean in the children of mothers who are homozygous, because this is a very serious developmental liability for the growing fetus to have a methyl tetrahydrofolate reductase deficiency. That's why folic acid has been able to prevent spina bifida and anencephaly and some horrible birth defects, because folic acid fixes this. But the type of folic acid that's necessary is not just good old-fashioned folic acid in a B vitamin for someone who has this profound,
yeah,
genetic deficiency. It's, you have to use methylfolate.
Mm-hmm.
And
always methylfolate.
Yeah, and there's a website on MTHFR that's fascinating. It's mthfr.net run by a doctor named Dr.
Is it Ben Lynch?
Ben Lynch. Yeah, I'm looking at it right here. And it's complicated because these guys run all day forums on the ramifications of MTHFR abnormalities. So I'm not going to simplistically say, just take some folic acid, that's enough. I think there's more to it than that. And
mm-hmm,
we have to learn more about the relationship between MTHFR defects and all kinds of problems. There's all kinds,
wow,
of issues that are associated with that. So, among the problems that are associated with it, I see that, looking at his website, I see there are 4,578 research articles on MTHFR. And here's one. Are genes connected with MTHFR associated with bipolar disorder? Are they associated with blood clots? Are they associated with the risk of autoimmune diseases? Are they associated with the risk of birth defects? Are they associated with cancer even? So there's a whole lot of information, and we're just beginning to scratch the surface. I would actually suggest that because, you know, homozygous. Wait a minute.
They're both homozygous.
Do they have children yet?
Yes, they have grown children.
Wow.
They have grown children.
The children need to be checked too,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
And because I do check on that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And they even say that
both children are healthy, she says.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Risk factor for multiple myeloma potentially. And look, I'm not trying to be alarmist, but I think that there's a lot of potential.
Folate is such an important cancer preventive,
yes.
And if they have this genetic mutation, they need to make sure that they're taking methylfolate. Nutrigenomics
right.
is so
right.
fascinating.
Oh. But it could also be responsible for certain challenging mental disorders. You know, perhaps it plays a role in attention deficit disorder and in depression mm-hmm. and in autism. So certainly these are issues that can be important. So I think it's a little cavalier to say, oh, your homocysteine is normal. Okay, forget about it. Don't worry.
So that's not the only marker of everything's
fine
with this
genetic. No, it could be normal. It could be high, but it could be normal.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
What else you got?
I believe that's essentially.
Have you shot your wad on that?
Yes. I think so.
Okay. Any important announcements we have this week?
Stay warm.
Stay warm.
This dreadful winter.
Hang in there because spring is around the corner. March comes in like a lion but goes out like a lamb. So
I don't believe it.
Well, it's 20-some degrees outside. It's very raw, too. It's raw and it's gray. And there's this scrum of icy, black, encrusted snow on the ground.
You just described seasonal affective disorder.
Now, you know what's interesting is that on Ash Wednesday,
mm-hmm.
that's this week, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what I used to think is it's such a gray time of year
mm-hmm.
that I would say, you know, there's no disrespect to the practicing Catholics who do this, but I would say this is the perfect time of year to put like this sooty kind of mark on your forehead because it matches the soot on the snow in our urban environment in New York. It sort of looks all part of that gray.
Ugh. Yeah.
It's getting, you know. Anyway. Yeah. So hopefully by the time we do our next podcast, we'll have better news to report. But hey, hang in there, folks. Keep exercising. By the way, we did a podcast on how to avert the winter blahs. So if you go back, I think it was last week, I talked to Stuart Tomk. I think it was a week ago last Friday,
mm-hmm.
Before our last snowstorm. we talked about, it was timely because I was saying to myself, is this too late in the season to do something about the winter blahs? I mean, it's almost March. And I was like, sure enough, there was a perfectly appropriate podcast because it ain't looking one iota better.
Yeah. Got to travel south.
All right. On that hopeful note, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Dr. Hoffman.
I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. You've just listened to a free podcast brought to you by yours truly and the Hoffman Center. F-R-E-E is my favorite four-letter word, but these podcasts do involve time and money to produce. And so in the spirit of defraying some of our very real production costs and to keep these podcasts flowing, I'd like to ask you to consider a couple of things. First, if you like what you're hearing, please share these podcasts with your friends and relatives. Our object is to continue the spectacular growth of the Intelligent Medicine Podcast with the goal of attaining 250,000 podcast downloads per month in 2014. I know that with the help of dedicated listeners like you, it'll happen. Second, go to drhoffman.com and click on the store and consider buying your supplements via our convenient internet portal. Or call the Hoffman Center and talk to one of our friendly supplement advisors. We only stock the very highest quality supplements, some of which are very hard to find elsewhere. The very same supplements that I talk about here on Intelligent Medicine and that I prescribe to my patients at the Hoffman Center.
And finally, consider becoming a patient at the Hoffman Center. I can personally perform an extensive work upon you, applying all the intelligent medicine principles that you hear about on these podcasts, or alternatively, make an appointment with Layla Mutin, our Hoffman Center nutritionist. You already know her as a frequent contributor on intelligent medicine, and she'll provide you with expert advice on diet and supplements. Anyway, thanks for listening, and continue enjoying our Intelligent Medicine podcasts.